Shanghai Commercial Bank versus Chang.
Good morning. I'm John Tollefson, representing the appellant. There's Chris Rossford, who did the laboring oar on the brief. And I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please. Okay. Our clients learned that the $21 million was missing from the family account in Hong Kong, and they owed $8.8 million approximately U.S. on a credit line that was supposed to be covered by the account, and not and the money was not supposed to be advanced more than 75% of the value. And they had been lied to about the amount in the account.
You can help me with kind of a fundamental question here, and that is, how does the imposition of security for costs in your lawsuit filed in Hong Kong impact the ability to defend the 806 action by the bank against the Changs?
All right, the default was, what happened is that when they didn't post security for costs, the court gave them a two-week extension, and then there were two default judgments given the same day by the same judge at the same time, both 806 and 1996. They had to have the 1996 case because most of the loss was at BEA. So if BEA is not in the case, they're not going to be able to recover most of the loss for the fraud. That's the 1996. So once they can't get access to justice,
the 806, though?
Excuse me?
Can they still defend the 806 cause of action?
Well, since most of the losses
are... I don't understand why most of the loss has any bearing on whether you can or can't defend the small claim.
Well, because they have a loan. They owe the money on the loan. The offset is the fact that the money was stolen improperly when their bank officer was at the other bank.
You can't pursue the big claim because of the requirement to post security. Why can't you still defend the small claim?
They owe the loan. The claim is that BEA stole the money, and BEA has to come in and pay it. There's also other problems. In Hong Kong, you got a prohibition order, ex parte. At any time, once they have a judgment against them, at any time, the other side can come in and restrict our clients from leaving Hong Kong, and they cannot leave Hong Kong until they pay the judgment.
Why do they have to be personally present to defend the 806 action? Why can't counsel represent them, submit declarations?
Well, to do the 806 action, you've got to show the losses at BEA. You can't show that. So all you can say is that, yes, we signed this loan, the loan was advanced, and the only defense...
Are you telling us your client owed the money owed to Shanghai Bank, and the only defense is somebody besides us ought to pay it because they took our money?
No. These cases are tied together. This officer of the bank started at Shanghai Bank. Then he goes to BEA. He loses most of the client's money at BEA. Then he comes back. In order to get the money back from BEA, he has to get this loan facility. To get them to sign the loan facility, he lies and says, we need this loan facility to get the account back. He says there's still $22 million in it. Turns out it's not true. And so they lose their money. But what they would be facing in Hong Kong is they'd have a judgment in 1996. All the EA would have to do is ask for securities for costs in 806 in front of the same judge.
But they didn't.
Well, because they don't have to, because it was a default. The default was given on the same day. If they had gone ahead and said, we're going to go ahead and fight this action, then all BEA, what Shanghai Bank would have done is motion for security for costs. It's already law of the case. It's a foregone conclusion they would have to pay securities for costs.
The security for costs, is it clear that it applies to counterclaims?
Yes, if you're the aggressor. And the way we read the ruling of that judge, it applies to both of them. But remember what this case is about. We're not matching up the judgment. We're saying, was there procedural due process? Did our clients have a chance in Hong Kong court to present their case?
I had a two-day hearing. The court issued a written ruling where the court went through the common law factors, case law factors.
On a default?
No, on the security for costs.
Yeah, on the security for costs, though, that was whether they should put up money for the... That wasn't on the merits of the fraud claim.
But I thought your argument was we're denied due process because they imposed a security deposit.
Well, there's several things that have to be said about that. First of all, our court here said that you have to prove that you don't have money. You can't prove that. That's impossible. You'd have to show you don't have a bank account in any country in the world, that you've never won a lottery in any country. You can't prove it.
Why can't you just say in a declaration, here's the amount of money I have, and it's not very much?
Well, the Hong Kong court said you have to include your family money plus any retirement money you have. You have to prove your family doesn't have any money.
Is there was money, and you didn't want to tell them about it because you wouldn't be able to show you couldn't post security, given what they consider to be available to post security?
There's no supersedious bond in this case.
Well, you didn't answer my question.
Well, there's nothing in the record on that.
Why didn't your client make some effort to show lack of assets?
Well, he hired Hong Kong counsel who we thought presented that, and you have that record in front of you. He did make a declaration that he couldn't afford to pay it, and he asked that it not be payable in cash, that he allowed to post.
Given the opportunity to prove something and he chooses not to present evidence, how is that a denial of due process?
Because you can't prove this. To deny access to the courts and access to justice because you're not rich enough to, or you have to prove you're not rich enough in order to get access to the court.
Let me ask you it this way. If you were in Washington, King County Superior Court, and the court came in under the Washington statute applying security for costs, and the person opposing said, I don't have enough assets, it's not fair, could they prove it there?
I don't think you can prove that you don't have assets. You might have assets in your backyard buried. We don't know. All you can do is find a declaration. That's not proof.
Well, then the Ninth Circuit standards for security for costs, as well as the stifling standard under the Hong Kong rule, are meaningless, right?
No, none of them address these constitutional issues. Not one of the cases cited.
How do you ever find someone's indigent and appoint counsel for them, given what you've represented is impossible to prove?
Well, the judge has to make a ruling. There's suspicion on that. But let me just mention, I don't know how you'd prove the negative. But on the Ono case that was cited, the 19th Circuit 2013 case, it actually goes our way. In that case, the court says scholars have struggled in determining when judicial action is state action. And it cites one case. It cites Dahl v. Aiken. And in Dahl v. Aiken says it's always state action if there's a denial of procedural due process.
What's the difference as a practical matter about state action? Because under 3H, proceedings not compatible with due process, we get to due process. Under 3G, repugnant to Washington policy, we get to equal protection. But whether or not you got state action, aren't those two concepts in play anyway?
No, it says may. The statute says you may. Somehow there's a judicial discretion whether to apply the Constitution or not.
Whereas if it's state action?
There's no discretion. If procedural due process is denied, regardless of how the Hong Kong procedure worked out, if they weren't given the opportunity to present their case, you look at the Dahl case the Ninth Circuit case, and since it's procedural due process, it's always state action. And I'm out of my time.
How do I always get last on the docket? There's a reason. I don't know what it is. Your Honor, Stelman Cannell of DLA Piper for Respondent Shanghai Commercial Bank, and with me is the person in my office who's done much of the briefing, Stephen Shea. Your Honors, you can affirm on either of two grounds, or both. One is that there simply wasn't an order for costs in the matter that brings us here today, and that is Hong Kong High Court Action 806. That is the sole action that's before us today. It is the sole action which is the predicate for the judgment that was entered in Hong Kong, and it's the only reason we're even in front of you. There's a second reason you could decide to affirm, and that is even if there had been an order for costs, which there wasn't, due process was fully accorded under Hong Kong procedures, which indeed do comport with U.S. procedures. Let me turn first to the principal ground, which I think you should affirm the grant of summary judgment and that is that there simply wasn't a security for costs in 806. And
what is the relationship between 806 and 1996?
So they're really reverse images of themselves, Judge Verrellen. And Shanghai Commercial Bank decided not to seek security for costs because in 806 it was the actual plaintiff. The only place it decided enough is enough, we're going to go ask for security costs against Katie Chang, was in the lawsuit he affirmatively brought, in which not only did he seek, as Mr. Tollefson said, reimbursement, but he made a claim for an excess of $30 million for supposed securities fraud.
Could they have asked for security for costs on the counterclaim in 806?
They could have, Your Honor, and they opted not to. There simply is no security for costs. Never applied for, never granted. So what's odd here is in the effort to make up for the fact that there isn't an 806 security for costs, Mr. Chang tries a couple of things for the plaintiff. I don't very often get to be the plaintiff, and I get confused sometimes. One thing he says is in his briefing, well, but the 1996 security for costs order is the reason I decided not to show up for my trial in 806. Now, I think it doesn't really matter because Hong Kong procedure is much like British procedure with some exceptions. Importantly, trials really are on the affidavits, including experts. So it's really a trial by paper in the Hong Kong system. There's very little oral testimony. So essentially, let's keep this in mind. There was no default judgment in any of these cases. All three were decided on the merits, ultimately, with the judge having...
No one has to be present.
No one has to be present.
Is there any, if they're mirror images, is there any collateral estoppel or res judicata that would apply from having defaulted in 1996?
There isn't. But what's interesting here, in addition to Mr. Katie Chang never coming forward and saying, in response to our summary judgment motion, that the reason he didn't proceed in 806 personally and just relied on the paper record was because of the 1996 order. That's just not... The record is bereft of a factual statement to that effect by Mr. Chang. So putting that aside and coming directly to your question, I don't think so, but this court can't decide that. And why is that? Because under Washington law, any issues of foreign law, foreign international law, have to be proved by an expert declaration by the person who knows that foreign law. Both sides presented expert declarations. You've seen them. But on Mr. Chang's side, the expert didn't come forward and say exactly your question, and that is somehow the 1996 order for costs becomes an 806 order for costs. No, there was no hint of that in the record. We've been through the record in the Hong Kong proceeding, and not before you.
Of the question of is it reasonable to say it's not a fair process when if you get tagged in the 1996 action, if it's a fait accompli in the 806 action, whether you try to defend 806 or not, you're down the tubes because you've been defaulted on the 1996.
Well, yeah, it's not quite that simple, Your Honor, for several reasons. First, remember that in the 1996 and there's yet another case, 805, it wasn't just that the judge, after hearing all the evidence and issuing his 15-page order, said, okay, your cases are over, push posh. Instead, he said, you have time to present your funds. Weeks later, he gave them another extension. You have time to post your funds. Meanwhile, 806 is not really proceeding because suddenly the Tanner DeWitt firm over in Hong Kong is kind of heading for the exits. Don't know why. Nobody knows why. The record doesn't show why. And only later, in a subsequent proceeding, does Judge Poon finally say, enough's enough. The security costs order was never satisfied. I'm going to enter an order saying, you know, and he says, I've got the whole record in front of me, but I'm going to enter an order. You can't proceed on those particular claims, the $30 million claim. So,
can I ask you a question?
But yes.
Before Judge Poon entered the order requiring the security, could the plaintiff in that case have voluntarily dismissed it to avoid any preclusive effect?
I'm not an expert on Hong Kong law.
Fair enough.
I have no reason to believe that he couldn't. I mean, it follows the British system, which, you know, we're really descendants of the British systems, although we've done our own thing too. I have no reason to believe he couldn't. He would have been precluded from doing that, but he opted not to do that. You know, when we get to the due process question, if we get to it, which we really shouldn't, because the fact is, you can't just take 1996 and say, now it applies to 806. There's nothing in the record that supports that, nothing. But even if you get to the due process considerations, I mean, if you look at all the things that Justice Poon went through, I mean, 2 days of hearing. Who over here would get a two-day hearing on an order to post costs, right, on a proceeding like this? It was an extraordinary amount of attention paid to this. 2 days of hearing, 15-page order, well-reasoned, explicit consideration whether there would be what in Hong Kong is called stifling. In other words, the very issue that's before us today, Judge Poon took under consideration and said, I have to decide under the decided precedents governing me here whether this is going to result in stifling. And what he really wanted to see was, what were the assets? Because a plea was made, now what you've asked for, which was $385,000 roughly U.S. for our proceeding, for the one that involves Shanghai Commercial Bank over on the 1996 side, $385,000. And what the Changs kept saying to the judges, we have plenty of assets to support a judgment. We have all these assets over in the state of Washington, including a bunch of retirement-type accounts. And then when he pressed them and said, okay, let's show me what you don't have, when they then came back and said, oh, but wait, now that you're going to impose security for costs, we can't satisfy that. He was clearly frustrated, and he said, why do you not come forward and just tell me what you got? And several of the members of the panel have already observed, it's not different really from a U.S. proceeding where you're proceeding indigently, or indeed if you were proceeding under the Washington statute. You'd have to come forward and say, here are what my assets are. Because in Hong Kong, and it's not even clear in the United States other than in the indigency proceeding that you would have to prove this, but in Hong Kong, there has to be some consideration taken of whether the party could meet the security for costs, right? That's an explicit criterion that Judge Poon had to consider, and that's where he really grew frustrated with the refusal, frankly, the refusal of Katie Chang to come forward and say, okay, here's what I've got. I'm going to tell you here's what I've got, and this is why I can't make the security for costs order. And I think under the circumstances, if he had really been able to demonstrate that he couldn't make that, there might have been a different issue. And here's one that we haven't focused on much.
In remaining time, maybe I can ask you to quickly address, do we need to worry about state action for the mandatory?
No, you don't really need to reach the issue. But the fact is the Ono case, I think, is spot on, and it says what it says. I'm going to leave the court and the clerks to read that. I think it is spot on. There isn't state action. Last point in the due process issue, there's a right of appeal from a order for costs entry. No appeal taken. And then when final judgment was entered in Hong Kong on 806, no appeal taken. It's just odd, distinguished panel, that we are here today talking about whether there's been a deprivation of due process, supposedly, in a proceeding that really was ancillary to our proceeding and didn't affect it anyway, when the appellant here didn't even avail himself of the due process that's fully available under the Hong Kong system, which really is part of the British system, and they have the whole, you know, the elevated proceeding, and they actually use Commonwealth judges from Australia and Great Britain, et cetera. I don't understand that. There's not one word said, and maybe in the 2 minutes we have from, we're going to hear from appellant, maybe they'll tell us why they didn't appeal. Thank you. Ask you to affirm.
4 minutes.
I'd like to point out that the legal counsel for Kung Dun, his father, withdrew on May 25th. It's in the MAC declaration. And the case management order said that they were acting pro se and were not present. So the default judgment, the two judgments that they got that are identical, all that happened is Shanghai Commercial Bank decided to enforce one. But the point I'm trying to make is you don't have to put up money to have due process. What if my client had come in and said, I only have $200,000? And the court says, okay, put up $200,000 for security for costs. Well, now he has no money for legal fees. It's the same thing as denying access to justice. He's got to go ahead and prove.
We don't have that case because because we have no idea what your client's reason.
Right, but what you're doing, you're also assuming that if he had come forward and showed that he had less money, that the security costs would have been dropped.
You're asking us to assume that he has less money.
Well, I'm trying to oppose counsel who's trying to assume that he has money.
The order is for $385,000. You've made no showing, your client made no showing, that that was even a significant amount of his resources available. So you're asking us to engage in a presumption.
No, I'm saying that you're denying access to justice. You make it put up $880,000 in order to get to court because you're a non-resident. But if you're a poor Hong Kong resident, you get access to justice. But if you're a non-resident, you don't get access to justice unless you put up $880,000. And you've got to prove that you can't. And if you prove you can't, we'll make it, we'll take the rest of your asset.
Is there a case anywhere that's ever held a security for cost provision is constitutionally defective?
We found none, and we found none that considered the question. This is an 1884 statute from Washington, and it has security for costs between counties. So if you're not a resident of King County, you have to put up securities costs in King County. I've never seen it apply, but that's what it says. It's unconstitutional. It's denying access to justice.
I want to make sure. Did you reserve 4 minutes? I'm sorry.
No, I think two.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. That concludes our session.